Good morning. It is December 11th, 2011. Running a little bit late, but for a good cause. Minion with Kaddish. We had bagels. So today we're continuing our confronting chosenness with Matan Torah in rabbinic thought. To give a brief summary of what we've done up until now, we spent some time in the biblical period distinguishing between the covenants of Abraham and covenants with the Jewish people at Har Sinai, and the differences between those, one having, we mentioned, you know, with Abraham it was a little more out of the blue, there was nothing really attached to it. With the Har Sinai, there seemed to have been some of a legacy, some legacy with the having picked up from Abraham, and then further on in the actual Brit, we had conditions attached to that covenant of we are going to be God's people if we agree to do what God says. We spent some time last week with rabbinic interpretations of the Abrahamic covenant, and when you had the biblical verses that seem to be kind of arbitrary, of God coming out of the blue telling Abraham, you know, go do this, with very little backstory, the Gemara and various rabbinic sources fill in the story a little bit more about why Abraham in particular was worthy, and sort of addressing that issue, because you could just turn, well, why did God choose Abraham over anyone else? The Torah doesn't actually say, so Chazal kind of fill in those gaps. Which also kind of changes the narrative. Instead of being, you know, just randomly chosen by God, that there was something that Abraham did that made him worth,
How does Chazal know that far back?
So that's a great question. And, you know, you can view it not necessarily as a matter of history, of trying to say, well, this is a factual thing of what happened, but rather Chazal could be trying to give you different dimensions or teach you different things. So we're going to see that today. And it's an important question with a lot of Agadot. And whether or not you view the Agadic statements as historical. By historical, I mean, was it intended to be historical? It's about someone telling you, here's what happened factually. Or perhaps they're trying to tell you something else. Perhaps they're trying to give you a more homiletic teaching. Or perhaps they're trying to address an issue that people realized was problematic or difficult somehow theologically. In the case of Abraham, you could ask, if you're, say, not Jewish, a reasonable question, what did Abraham do that he merited to be chosen by God as opposed to anyone else? Right? So that's, you know, a serious question to ask. So, you know, sages, you know, give other answers for that, you know, to try to address it. Because in the Bible, you don't have a set indication. And then God tells Abraham, you know, lech lecha, go, you know. How do you know he did that? All the Torah tells you is, with the first introduction of Abraham, is God tells Abraham, Lech lecha mi'aretzecha mi'ladetecha mi'beit avicha. The whole thing about recognizing one God, who we saw last week, was a rabbinic source that, you know, we now, you know, it's almost, I use the idiom here just because I'm a geek, of a retcon. If anyone's a fan of comic books, since you've got, you know, years of, you know, stories and continuity, sometimes a new writer will come in and come out with a story that happened earlier that, you know, sort of reinforms all these other stories. It's called retroactive continuity. You know, you could view not, I mean, lahavdil is a matter of fiction, but in terms of a way of interpreting the text, you have later sources that you read back in. One of the difficulties, though, with doing that with Midrashim is that some of them are mutually contradictory. And you know, we discuss that every week Friday night when we go through Midrashim. We do some Midrashim that, you know, might not be as well known or might raise other difficulties based on other ones. That said, today we're going to do something similar with the narrative of Matan Torah. Right, we saw the biblical verses several weeks ago about God giving the Torah to the Jewish people. So today, we're going to see a few instances of the sages reading into a little more of what happened behind the scenes. And we're going to discuss a few of the implications, and this will actually serve as a really nice segue, because the whole point of this confronting chosenness is largely how are Jews relating to non-Jews. So we, you know, had to first establish the chosenness aspect. We saw a few things with Abraham. I think maybe one or two about you've got Abraham as distinct from, as a peoplehood, children of Abraham distinct from the rest of the world. Here you have the Jewish people as more of what we would call a religion, about having God's divine Torah. How do we act on this divine Torah as making us distinct from others? All right, and we're going to see how that plays out in some rabbinic sources. I gave the source sheet a little bit more thought, so we're going to do it a little bit out of order based on what I printed here. For those who are following online, the uploaded source sheet will reflect these changes. The first source I'd like to do is from Vayikra Rabba, Leviticus Rabba, Shmini 13:2. Let's start us off. This is in this source. What I have labeled here is 2, but soon to be fixed.
Leviticus Rabba, Shmini
13:2.
Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai opened the discourse with, "He rose and measured the earth. The Holy One, blessed be He, considered all generations, and He found no generation fittest to receive the Torah other than the generation of the wilderness. The Holy One, blessed be He, considered all mountains and found no mountain on which the Torah should be given other than Sinai. The Holy One, blessed be He, considered all cities and found no city wherein the temple might be built other than Jerusalem. The Holy One, blessed be He, considered all lands and found no land suitable to be given to Israel other than the land of Israel. This is indicated by what is written, He rose and measured the earth,
right,
and He released nations."
The operative line here that I want to focus on is that Madat Haaretz, Madat HaKadosh Baruch Hu Kol HaUmot, He evaluated all of there are no other generations, although the truth is here, this is Cincinnati's translation isn't quite accurate here. Umot really would refer to all nations. V'lo matza umash ayetza ro'i l'kabel et ha-Torah, but He did not find a nation that was worthy to accept the Torah, except for the Dor HaMidbar, except for the generation of the desert.
Huh.
Now, this is a fascinating statement for a whole bunch of reasons here, because you assume, you know, the Torah is, and, you know, people will actually make this argument for, you know, religion in general and revelation, where, you know, if God, in fact, did reveal Himself to certain people and God's intent is for people to do what He wants, wouldn't it have made more logical sense for God to do His revelation at numerous other points in history? Then let's assume for a moment that time is meaningless to God. You know, God doesn't work on the linear space-time continuum. Got a lot of deep references today. So why specifically this generation? Right? God could give the Torah to pretty much, you know, even if you want to say, and the language here in Vayikra Rabba is ummah, which would really mean nation. So you're not just talking about the Jewish people. Like, of all the other people, history of time, this was the generation that was somehow worthy of it. Or even if you want to stick with the Jewish people in terms of descendants of Abraham, or Abraham, then why specifically this generation? Was there really none better to receive? I mean,
well,
you
it's
could...
Also, it's also a, the way it's phrased is a reflection on the notion of nation that you're... Mm. It's not that you looked around nations, you saw that this group of people at this particular time
right.
was most and it, outside of any definition of nation.
So that's so that's a way of looking at it too, in that, you know, what is the comparison? Is the ummah compared to all of space and time? Mm-hmm. Is the ummah compared to all the other nations at that point? But then you could still ask, well, why did God give the Torah at that time? Because you look at the rest of the Torah, the Dor HaMidbar didn't do that well.
Right.
I know, maybe, you know, at the time the Torah was given, you know, they were, I mean, they just, you know, came out of 210 years of slavery, so you'll cut them a little bit of slack. But, you know, were they really, like, that worthwhile?
Well, they were also condemned to die in the desert.
Well, because of other stuff that they did subsequently.
Yeah.
But, like, the argument is that that's the best you got.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, George?
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. They make the idol.
The golden calf immediately afterwards, sure.
They want to go back to Egypt, flesh pots.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that seems that this would be the least.
There, and there is, I believe there's an opinion in Chalak that says, you know, they don't even have Olam Haba.
Huh?
Yeah, there's an opinion like that. You know, it takes a lot more time. We'll have to spend some more time in that Gemara and Chalak. But the point is, you know, on one hand, I mean, in context of the Midrash, the point is, God does everything for a reason, and then it's not just an arbitrary choosing of one or the other, but there is an element of being ra'ui. there is a qualitative advantage over all of these choices that God made. You can say, well, why did God do it for this people? Why did God do it on this mountain? Why did God choose this land? Why here? Why this? And the answer is, God actually measures this stuff out such that he finds something better about one to the other, and then you can extrapolate, well, you know, why. So here it's more of, you can say that the point of this midrash is trying to ascribe some sort of motive to divine choice, in that we might not necessarily be able to figure out what, but there's a certain degree of faith that God found something, some quality in all of these things that was superior to the alternatives, which is why God did this here, God did this there, etc.
The big point of rationalist spirituality is that this is the best of all possible. It couldn't have happened in a better way because God does.
There you go. Yeah, Ed.
I just want to say, I'm sorry that you're skipping number one, because...
No, we're not skipping it. We're not skipping that. We're just doing it in a different order.
Yeah,
I promise you...
Hashem doesn't come out looking for good.
I promise you we're going to get there. There's a reason... When I put it together, I thought about doing it one way, and I thought the flow would work better. I promise you, it's on the sheet. We're going to do it in a different order. All right? I'm not going to put it on the sheet and say, oh, don't look at that one.
Right.
All right? So here, at least, we find something about the Jewish nationhood that makes them more worthy than others. I think the way that you interpret it made a little more sense in terms of compared to the other nations at the time, but the language of the Midrash and Vayikra Rabbah could also be read in terms of, well, since the Dora Midbar wasn't that great, couldn't you have done it at a better time? Meaning, why specifically did these people need the Torah? I mean, Torah wasn't given until that point. Couldn't the Torah have been given, say, earlier? Maybe to Abraham directly. Maybe to the children of Yaakov, right? You know, and do it then. And, you know, or maybe like, I mean, you could argue, actually, though, after the Jewish people entered the land of Israel, we didn't get better. You know, so you could argue in terms of nation, it was like, you know, we weren't that great in the Midbar, but it's not like subsequent generations improved. So many things I realized, you know what, that's actually the best we're going to be.
I guess.
Which is kind of sad.
Although I guess we always, when we think of like salvation and things like that, I think we think of, we tend to depict the Solomonic era as the pinnacle of, you know, what we want to return to, or...
Yeah, it didn't end so well, though.
It didn't end very well, either. Everything is, like, so short.
Yeah.
It's such a short golden age.
Really?
Yeah.
The very purpose of the prophets was to say, hey, you people are bad, correct your ways, this is the way you should be going.
Yeah.
So we were very good.
Absolutely. So George, take on this. What I have in the second page here, Lamentations or Echa Rabbah 3. Turn the page. What I have here is 4. We'll do the second. This is Echa Rabbah from section 3. It says, this is the verse that states. Second, last verse.
Last one.
Yeah.
This which is the verse states, like the rising sun, he shone on his people from Mount Seir. He shone on them from Mount Paran. Initially, God took the Torah to Asa from Mount Seir. He said to them,
That should be do your will. I wasn't sure quite how to translate this. In the Echarab, it says, Mekablima tem haTorah. Some people, you could read this as a question in terms of like, will you? Tell this as Mekablima, or like some sort of directive of, you know, it probably, you know, reading it as a question makes a little more sense. There could be some other semantic ways of reading this. So for the moment, let's read it as, you know, do you accept the Torah? Right. So do you accept the Torah as opposed to like, will you accept the Torah? It's not like, do you accept the Torah? Let's, you know, use that. So they asked the Eitav, do you accept the Torah? Yeah.
But the blessing of your father...
Well, no, it's actually, they inquired. You skipped a line. It's like, do you accept the Torah? They inquired.
Oh, okay. They inquired, what is written in it? God replied, do not murder. They said, but the blessing your father gave us was, you will live by the sword. We cannot live without this. And they did not accept it. God went to Paran, to the Ishmaelites. He said to them, do you accept the Torah? They inquired, what is written in it? God said, do not steal. Ishmaelites replied, "This is the inheritance from our father. His hand will be against every man, and every man's hand against him."
Using the language in terms of Yado, is his hand actually like taking stuff from his fellow?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, continue.
We are not able to live without this. And they did not accept the Torah. God went to the Ammonites and Moabites and said, "Do you accept the Torah?" They asked what is written in it. God answered, "Do not commit adultery." They replied, "But the essence of our people is only based on Mamzerot."
Mamzerut. I really don't know how to translate that, but I can explain. Yeah.
Where it says the two daughters of Lot were impregnated.
I mean, the nations of Ammon and Moab were the product of incest. Right? So, and interestingly enough, the pasuk that's cited here is lo tin'ah, which means don't commit adultery, but the problem here wasn't really adultery as much as incest, and there are psukim in the Torah that say, you know, don't lie with your daughter, but anyway.
We cannot survive without this, and they did not accept it. God then went to the Jews and asked, "Do you accept the Torah?" They answered, "Yes." Yes, whatever God says, we will do and obey.
I have to.
One second. Hold on. We have to explain a few things here. So the reason probably why you use lo tin'ah is that the three statements that were made were all from the Aseret HaDibrot. Meaning not exactly, you know, lo tirtzach, lo tignov, and lo tin'ah. So, yes, even though, you know, like the prohibition against incest does come later, you know, this Midrash is focusing in particular on the, you know, on the Aseret HaDibrot. Two, and people have probably heard this story in, you know, different forms, in terms of God going mm-hmm. to the other nation and saying, you know, do you do this, do you do that, do you do that? The response is here.
From the Torah.
Exactly. Meaning, I think, chronologically, even though we're doing this in a second, it is a relatively late Midrash, and I'll explain why. But you could also understand at the time, like, these are some of the major biblical... some of the major nations at the time, and there was a sense of saying, well, here's why the Jewish people were actually merited it, that there was something in the Torah that the other nations just couldn't do because it was against somehow their very nature. And this speaks to, we saw like in the previous source of Yikra Rabbah, that there was something better, that the Jewish people were Ra'oi. This gives a certain level of what made them Ra'oi, and that, you know, the Jewish people, you know, said yes, and everyone else said no. And here it reads in that there was something intrinsic about, you know, the other nations that, again, notably based on the Torah, that was a problem. But also throw in that, you know, there are people that joke today about, like, different people today, you know, well, we'll skip the jokes on that, yeah. Ed.
Yeah, in this particular thing, the only naive, unsuspecting simpletons were the Jews. They said, yeah, we'll take, they didn't even look, which doesn't make them look too smart to me.
So there are, you know, some statements about that. On the other hand, if the implication is, and there are actually, you know, sources that talk about, in fact, funny you mention that. There is actually a Gemara that talks about a certain min who said that exact argument. It's like, you just, you know, accept without knowing what you're doing. The answer given in the Gemara is, well, this is, you know, in terms of the showing of, like, a display of faith and righteousness is, you first make the commitment to God to do it. In terms of, like, what's the real commitment in God is, you accept what God does first, and then you actually, you know, do what's told. But a priori, you make that acceptance and that commitment to God, and then, you know, you figure out the details afterwards. And Gemara actually views this as, you know, very positively, as a significant sign of faith. However, you know, this is one narrative in terms of how things went down. There is another one that, you know, is also a well-known source, but would seem to contradict the pure willingness of the Jewish people in this, you know, form of, like, why are the Jewish people so great? Well, we went to the other nations, they all said no, but the Jewish people, you know, they said yes. So, with that, turn, Billy, take us, the first source on the source sheets here, this, and we'll do third, is a Gemara in Shabbat 88a.
Who's doing it?
Bill.
Sorry. And they stood under the mount.
In the pasuk is Yitzvu b'tachtit ha'har. The biblical verse isn't just like, you know, sort of the foot. It literally means you stood underneath the mountain. Right? Literally. So go ahead.
Okay, so Rav Adimi Bar Kama Bar Hasa said, "This teaches that the Holy One, blessed be He, overturned a mountain upon them like an inverted cask, and said to them, 'If ye accept the Torah, 'tis well. If not, there shall be your burial.'"
Right, so...
That's funny.
Well, yeah, now, yeah, continue.
Rav Aha ben Jacob observed, "This furnishes a strong protest against the Torah."
Because you could reasonably argue, it's like, what's with this not seven Nishma thing if you were actually coerced, accepted, or die?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, continue.
Said Rava, "Yet even so, they reaccepted it in the days of Ahasuerus, for it is written, 'The Jews confirmed and took upon them,'" etc.
Kibu the Kiblu, yeah.
"They confirmed what they had accepted long before. Hezekiah said, 'What is meant by, thou didst cause sentence to be heard from heaven? The earth feared and was tranquil. If it feared, why was it tranquil? And if it was tranquil, why did it fear? But at first it feared, yet subsequently it was tranquil. It feared lest Israel would reject the Torah, and became tranquil when Israel accepted it. And why did it fear? Even in accordance with Resh Lakish. For Resh Lakish said, 'Why is it written, and there was evening and there was morning the sixth day? What is the purpose of the additional 'the'? This teaches that the Holy One, blessed be He, stipulated with the works of creation and said thereto, 'If Israel accepts this Torah, ye shall exist. But if not, I will turn you back into emptiness and formlessness.'"
Yeah. This puts Matan Torah in a very different light. I mean, there are a few important points to mention here. One is that the Torah, according to this interpretation, was initially given coercively. For even, you want to say, Na'aseh v'nishma, well, maybe it wasn't as much of a choice. Despite, like, the earlier statement of God going to the other nations, you know, well, what's the real difference here? It's like there's a, you know, there seems to be more coercion for the Jewish people. Hold on certain questions, because some of them are going to be addressed in the final source. Promise you on that. Right, so that's one issue. Two, you could also ask, well, you know, even according to Rabbah that says, you know, Kiblu, you know, Kimu v'Kiblu HaYehudim, that the Jewish people voluntarily accepted the Torah at the time of Ahasuerus, that was after the first exile. I mean, you could, in theory, ask, well, you know, we didn't really accept then. Like, there were a whole lot of punishments that came up for not following the Torah. You know, so there's a bit of a gloss there in terms of, well, if you're going to say that there was a protest for the Jewish people, like, why did we have to keep the Torah when it was coerced upon us? And Rava is saying, well, we accepted it again in the days of Ahasuerus willingly. That's great. But what about all that stuff in the books of Nevi'im that were based on that coerced acceptance? Still remain, you know, hold that off as an open question. And by the last line, there seems to be something about Israel's chosenness that isn't as much conditional on what the Jews would do, but almost primordial. You know, at the time of creation, God says, basically, according to, you know, Reish Lakish at least, the time of creation, God says the entire creation is dependent on the Jews accepting the Torah. Right, which puts the coercive side in another level. And like, you know, if we didn't, the world would have been destroyed. You know, that puts the whole issue of chosenness in a very different side. Is it really that the Jewish people agreed to sign on with God? Or, you know, was it really predetermined and predestined? Right? It's an important question to consider there. Yeah. Thoughts?
When God goes to the various nations and asks them to accept the Torah, when does that take place? And what is the Torah that he's asking them, if not in this chunk of history that spans a long period of time? So he's only asking them about one thing? Or what is the Torah at that point?
Alright, so you're trying to like fill in even more details to the Midrash itself. Yeah, the Midrash doesn't actually do that. Right, you'll notice that the Midrash is kind of selective, which is, you know, sort of an indicator that it was less about historical fact as much as what is the message or the point of the Midrash and what is it trying to teach or what problems are it trying to solve. And you know, and that's a question that, you know, people joke about when they say, you know, that the Avot, you know, like Yaakov, and you might, there's actually a YouTube video where someone did an Extra Normal thing, where Extra Normal is a website where you can make your own little cartoon animations, and someone had this exchange about, like, Shiva person giving a Dvar Torah, and someone asked, well, if Yaakov knew the entire Torah, couldn't he have read a few, you know, chapters ahead and saw that Yosef was actually in Egypt? You know, it's, you know, when you say, like, the whole term in terms of what that is, you know, much, you know, more complicated question than we'll get to here.
For example, the Torah is about Tzitzit. Doesn't ask anybody about Tzitzit.
Well, because the point of the Midrash is more of, you know, you could say...
What is it the topic to say?
You could argue, as a sign in terms of a Muta Olam, that there's something fundamentally flawed with these other nations. And here's what they are. Meaning, you know, Shatnez isn't the biggest of deal, but no one, like, you know, part, you could say that the entire Midrash is actually a dig against these other nations. To say that, you know, implying that Esav is all about murder, Yishmael is all about theft, Ammon and Moab are all about sexual immorality. And this is how you're defining them on the whole. And you're reading some of that into it. Also, one reason why... There's another reason why I think this kind of came in later, is that in the next verse we're going to see sort of an outline of it, like almost like a one-line summary that is then extrapolated in later sources, which you have, you know, not infrequently in rabbinic literature. So let's do the last source then, you know, if you still have more questions. And the last source here, which I think we're going to revisit next week as we spend some more time in, you know, now that we've spent a lot of time in terms of what makes the Jews, you know, Jews and distinct in some way, beginning of Avodah Zarah describes it in particular in contrast to the surrounding non-Jewish nations in various ways. So this is Gemara. I just took one small snippet from Avodah Zarah 2b, and you'll probably see more of this next week. The nations will then contend, Lord of the universe, hast thou given us the Torah, and have we declined to accept it? Meaning, this is part of a dialogue that nations have, you know, are going to have with God, right? But how can they argue thus, seeing that it is written, the Lord came from Sinai and rose from Seir unto them, he shone forth from Har Paran. It is also written, God cometh from Timan. What did he seek in Seir, and what did he seek at Mount Paran? So Rabbi Yochanan said, this teaches that the Holy One, blessed be he, offered the Torah to every nation and every tongue, but none accepted it until he came to Israel, who received it. That is the one line in the Gemara that you could think that maybe a later Midrash then went in and extrapolated it. You know, that's my guess. But I've got, you know, no real way of confirming it. But this is at least, and also,
well,
note,
that's the common, to all these versions, that's the common line.
But also note, that's the same line. This, you know, Misinai Vav Zarach Misinai Vav Zarach Misir Lamo. The Midrash that we saw from Echa Rabbah is based on that identical verse. Right? Mm-hmm. So the same type of drasha is made off of that verse, just you have more detail in one than you do right here. And here it's specifically to address the point, well, you know, if God's going to favor the Jewish people, like, couldn't the nations ask, well, didn't God, you know, shouldn't God have offered us the Torah too? So Rav Yochanan's answer is, God did, but no one else accepted it. Right? And again, you could also argue from a space-time continuum thing, if the intent is for God to, like, give, you know, have people worship the Torah, why can't God continuously give the Torah throughout time and space? Like, why was that a fixed point in time? I'll leave that as an open question. But going down the line, how then can they say the Torah was not offered to them? How then can they say the Torah was not offered to them? Their contention will be this: did we accept it and fail to observe it? But surely the obvious rejoinder to this, their plea would be to this, it should be a comma, this is since he knows here, then why did you not accept it? This then will be their contention: Lord of the universe, didst thou suspend the mountain over us like a vault, as thou hast done to Israel, and still did we decline to accept it. So remember that source that we saw from Shabbat, Kafalim Harkigigid. God sort of chose the Jewish people, right, to say, you know, if you don't accept it, I'm going to kill you. But did God give that ultimatum to the other nations? God gave that to another nation, maybe they would have accepted it just as much as the Jewish people. Now, even though in that narrative we don't have an issue of the Jewish people contesting any point in the Torah, you can still say there was a certain degree of coercion. So why did God choose the Jewish people to coerce and give them this non-option? What about the rest of the nations? For commenting on the person they stood at another part of the mountain. Rav Dimi Bar Chama said, this teaches that the Holy One, blessed be, suspended the mountain over Israel like a vault and said unto them, if you accept the Torah, it be well with you. If not, there you will find your grave, like we saw in Shabbat. Thereupon, Holy One, blessed be He, will say to them, let us consider the happenings of old. As it is said, let them announce to us former things. There are seven commandments which you did accept. Did you observe them? Meaning referring to the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noah. How do we know that they did not observe them? For if Joseph learned, he standeth and shaketh the earth, he seeth and makes the nation tremble. What did he see? He saw that the nations did not observe even the seven precepts which the sons of Noah had taken upon themselves. Seeing that they did not observe them, he stood up and released them therefrom. So what happened here? You had the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noah, which apparently the other nations of the world did not keep. Interestingly enough, in the Eicha Rabba, where we saw like the three things that were cited of Lo Tirtzach, Lo Tignov, Lo Tinah, all not just in the Aseret Dibrot, but there are also Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noah as well. So you can say, well, once you already don't accept the basics that you ought to, if you're already not doing stuff that you accepted, you know, generations before that, why am I going to force you to do it now? There's an implication being that, you know, the certain descendants of Noah actually did keep the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noah.
Was the implication that the Jewish descendants of Noah
kept it? Yeah. Now, Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noah, though, as you'll notice, aren't explicit in the Torah. We've got rabbinic, you know, teachings that, you know, sort of fill those in. Mm-hmm. You know, you could argue that what the sages are doing here, trying to address, and you know, we'll see it more in detail, the real question of what distinguishes the Jewish people from the non-Jews. And by non-Jews, like, it's, you know, referring to, you know, really all other, you know, nations of the world, of like what makes us unique. The logic here is, you know, and granted there's a bit of retroactive continuity of like trying to say, well, all this stuff happened. There's not necessarily historical evidence, you know, physical evidence to prove that such exchanges happened. They're not explicitly in the Torah, though the sages extrapolate from certain verses, like what does say, you know, like Zarach Meseir Lama, what does that mean? Is it a necessary read to mean, does that have to mean that God offered to give them the Torah? Not necessarily. I mean, commentaries, you know, give other interpretations of what that word means. But the sages are certainly trying to answer a difficulty in terms of, biblically speaking, don't the other nations have a claim? Right? If you want to set yourself up as a chosen people, you know, how do you do that if you had certain opportunities and someone else didn't? So on one end, you have a, you know, a reliance on the cosmic, you know, chosenness thing that we saw in in Shabbat, that if the Jewish people didn't accept it, the world would have been undone. Some way, like there was no possible way for the world to exist unless the Jewish people accepted the Torah. But as far as anything else, you focus on personal choice, and in doing so, you know, if you are answering a question of arbitrariness by ascribing to, say, Avraham Avinu, like we saw last week, here are certain things that he did that made him worthy. Here are certain statements that say, here's why the Jewish people were worthy. If not worthy on their own merit, why they're better than everyone else. Right? You factor in these two, you know, the exchanges here, you know, you could understand, like, why did God find the Jewish people more worthy than the other nations at that time? So here the sages provide certain answers. Now, if you are a non-Jew and you are, you know, raising a polemic against this, sure you can raise, you know, you've got questions to ask on this. But who are the people that you're trying to convince? Are you trying to answer non-Jews in terms of, like, why we think we're better than you? Or are you trying to address Jews in terms of, like, do you think you're better than other people? Or trying to give some sort of advantage to being Jewish? And what really makes you distinct? You know, these are important questions which we're going to spend a lot more time in the rabbinic, you know, period trying to answer in terms of what is the real intent of the Midrashim. Historical fact could be one of them, but that opens up a whole bunch of other questions. You know, that's one way of reading Midrashim. That's not necessary, and there are some opinions who believe that Midrashim should not be read, you know, as literal historic fact. But then if you're trying to say, well, what is the message that the sages are trying to do, you can, you know, there are a lot of different ways that you can explain that depending on your focus. This year, focus is on the chosenness aspect. not to say that these are exclusive ways of viewing it, but this is going to be the slant for this particular question: how could these sources inform? An audience, intended audience, I should say, is an important component. Who are you trying to convince? Are you trying to answer non-Jews who are trying to say that we are really the chosen people, you know, or, you know, we should, you know, be included in this? Or are you trying to, you know, reach out to your own people if you find that there's some sort of outside threat in terms of why you should stay with where you are and, you know, sort of reaffirming your own legitimacy internally? And you're going to have different rules in terms of what's an acceptable proof. If someone believes in the Torah, citing Psukim helps. Someone doesn't believe in the Torah, you're not going to be able to rely on the Torah to say, oh, here's why, you know, because, like, well, you haven't actually justified, you know, we spoke about this in our Fundamentals of Judaism class. All right? So, you know, in terms of the chosenness of the Jewish people with Matan Torah, you find at least some wrestling with the question of why the Jewish people. Like, yes, you can say, we were chosen because God gave us the Torah, but taking that step further, why did God give us the Torah? And you have a few answers to that question here, both in terms of why did God give us the Torah, you know, based on our own worthiness, or why did he give us the Torah as opposed to anyone else? Okay? And in terms of the anyone else, the statements that we have are at least minimally based on the nations that existed at the time of God giving the Torah. But we don't, right, at that, you know, that fixed point in time, we don't have the questions in terms of spanning time and space of why, you know, Dor Hamidbar as opposed to generations before or generations after. Yeah?
Past laws to ensure a certain kind of behavior of society. We pass negative things if we don't do such and such in order to ensure that you don't do it. In the Torah, almost throughout the whole Torah, warns the people not to follow other gods or other idols.
Yeah.
So if God had come to the Jewish people when he came to all the others and said, if you observe one God, you might say no.
So the there didn't, you know, when we saw the, that kind of gets addressed at the end of Yoshua. There was nothing, you could argue that there's a difference, I'm trying to answer this, with the other statements that were made in terms of Eicha Rabbah going to the other nations. The answer given by the nations were, you know, we have a pasuk that defines us in such and such a way. The Jewish people were not defined as they are by idol worship. It was something that they accepted, you know, yes, we're not going to do it. That doesn't mean that they actually, you know, kept up on it. They might have even theoretically thought, hey, we shouldn't do it, but they still kept on. At the end of, you know, Yoshua, when we discussed that chapter in the whole covenants type of thing, you know, Yoshua says, you have to worship God. They said, yes. No. You have to worship only God, you know, as opposed to that thing. And they agreed, yes. You know, said, okay, we're going along with that too. And it's possible to make that, you know, decision. Okay, sure, we'll worship God. Not everyone is, you know, necessarily so consistent, but, you know, just because we're inconsistent doesn't mean you accept, like, the whole, you know, system there, too. You know, but it's you know, a reasonable question. I mean, that actually goes back to the joke that I referenced earlier, which, you know, makes sense to throw in now about, you know, you go to other contemporary people today that you don't like and, you know, to make fun of them. Like, you go to Lakewood. What does it say in the Torah? Sheshet yamim ta'avod. You have to work for 6 days. I'm like, we don't do that. You know, I've also heard it applied to Chabad. You know, what does it say? Anochi Hashem Elokecha. I am the Lord your God. It's like, we don't do that. And these are, you know, jokes against, you know, certain things. Of like, you know, one group doesn't work, and elements, and you know the people who attribute divinity to, you know, the rabbi and stuff like that. So you could sort of extend it further, you know, that people do humorously. It doesn't seem to have been an issue here because at the end of the day, God did give the Jewish people the Torah, or alternatively, you could say He didn't give them that choice. You know. Let's say you want to reconcile Midrashim, which you don't necessarily have to do. But let's say you want to squeeze the two in the narrative. God could have suspended the mountain over them and asked them, do you accept the Torah? Now, if you're being coerced, you're not going to say what's in it. You're just going to say yes. So it's not just God took away the choice. You could also have it mean God took it away the ability to even pre-inquire and to even question. right? Which also like has that whole Na'aseh v'nishma, despite certain rabbinic sources that view it as, as you mentioned that earlier, a really great sign of faith, this sort of negates that element. Right? And another way of like why it's very dangerous to like try to have every single midrash harmonized, because the intention is to do different things. You know, you could argue that the tachtit haharm is, you know, solving an exegetical issue. You know, it's hard to say with that. But you could in theory answer it that way, that suspending the mountain took away the ability to ask, such that God didn't even ask the question because there couldn't have been any other response. Maybe. And I'd like to say I wasn't there, but there are midrashim that say that we were, so. yeah. All right. So next week we'll probably do more of the discussion from Avodah Zarah, because you'll have, you know, this is when we start getting to the dialogues of how do the Jewish people relate to non-Jews. You know, we'll spend some time with Agada, and we'll also spend some time with Halacha. And I think the two really do need to inform each other based on, you know, the needs that were going on in terms of certain drashot needed to be made to certain individuals based on what was going on for one reason or another. I don't think it was done in a vacuum. Sometimes we may find correlations, sometimes we may not find correlations, but historical context is usually important one way or the other, as other sources. So next week, spend some more time with the Avodah Zarah Bet, and Tuesday, if anyone is interested, we'll be discussing varieties of rabbinic fallibility in our Fundamentals of Judaism class, where we've been discussing, you know, various forms of rabbinic authority. All right? Have a wonderful week.